You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whai akane, come up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about government ministers announcing they are considering banning rough sleeping in Auckland CBD and the Regulatory Standards Bill passing its second reading. I also spoke to Marcelo Rodriguez Ferrer, an associate law professor at the University of Auckland, about New Zealand First's Members Bill proposing a ban on the private sale and use of fireworks, touching on why we are seeing so many members' bills from the party. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to lecturer in architecture and urban planning at the University of Auckland and lead researcher for the Future Cities Research Centre, Dr. Arish Jayawardena, about Earth Sciences New Zealand's new flood risk map and what it says about our infrastructure's exposure to climate-based harms.
He aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Te kapatuhi mai, you can text in on 5395, or why mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e ahena koutou, te whakaronga ki enei kororono, hei pakihiri rokiroki maronga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM i te katikam. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Concerns have been raised that rough sleepers will be pushed into unfamiliar suburbs outside of Auckland CBD following government ministers' consideration of new measures. Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith says he had been tasked with making sure police were equipped to halt public disorder. When questioned explicitly about the ban, he said, "We're working our way through those issues. When we've got something to announce, we'll announce that." As well as this, the Regulatory Standards Bill has passed its second reading in Parliament, having seen a few changes made to the bill in the Select Committee process. The bill, having received 156,000 public submissions, almost 99% in opposition to the bill, is controversial. Constitutional experts and critics of the bill have expressed concerns that the amendments do not address its failings, and the ideological way it has been written means that if passed, the bill will have a lasting impact. The bill also lacks references to Te Tiriti o Waitangi. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party Simon Court, I spoke to him about both of these topics. How does the ACT Party view these measures currently being considered?
Well, it begs the fundamental question. Why are these people on our streets? Why don't they have a home to go to? And if they don't, and that is one of the major issues that is causing their lives to spiral out of control, the need for a home, then we need to build homes for them. We can engage community housing providers to do that because they also provide wraparound health and mental health and addiction services. We need to get these people a place to go, but they cannot be on our streets because rough sleepers do make the city feel less safe. People in town are being abused, they're being forced to step around bodily fluids, there's people who are half naked, they're openly using drugs on the street. I have witnessed people fighting, and lots of other really, really outrageous behaviour over many, many years. It's got worse and worse. I managed a number of civil construction contracts in the CBD, particularly around the Kay Road precinct, over many years. And, even 10 or 12 years ago, while there were incidents and there were some people, it's nothing like what we have now. And so it is time to address it, but address it in a way that is not just about moving people on. There have to be solutions for these people. And, Joel, there have to be solutions that these people are required to accept, because unless there's some tension on them, they're just going to come back because The streets for many are actually part of their social life, whether that's something that gets talked about. It appears to be one of the driving reasons that they do come back.
A lot of services targeted at supporting those rough sleeping are based in the CBD. Are you concerned that if a move like this goes ahead, it would make it borderline impossible for rough sleepers previously in the CBT to receive this help?
Well, I'm sure that service providers can go to where the people are. I mean, it's not just because they have an office in the CBD doesn't mean that their outreach is limited to the CBD. But maybe we could flip this around. Now, if we said that, look, we're investing billions and billions of dollars in taxpayer-funded infrastructure like City Rail Linked, we're building these beautiful precincts like Britomart, Altea, like around Karangahape, and we actually want businesses to come and open up there and employ people. We want people to be living there in new residential apartments that are going to be built. We're going to have to do something to reduce the risk that rough sleepers cause to people coming and going. And, when I think about what this opportunity is, if we can provide those services to them in a place that is actually more affordable to deliver those services and with more options for working in the community, maybe that's a better thing to do. We can have it all, right? We can have a much improved, much safer CBD, and these people can get services. This is not a zero-sum game here.
ACT Party leader David Seymour, according to RNZ, was a little bemused on the topic when asked about it. Despite discussions of these measures still being in their very early stages, would the ACT Party like conversations like these to better include the party and even the government's other coalition partner, New Zealand First?
Well, I doubt David was bemused. David is the MP for Epsom, and he will be well aware of the problems that rough sleeping is causing for business districts. But then you look at Newmarket, for example. They have engaged their own private security service to police Newmarket to manage behaviour, and actually it's a much safer environment where people can come and go shopping, lots of schoolies coming in before and after school on their way to and from home. It is a much safer environment in Newmarket in David Seymour's electorate than it is just up the road in Chloe Swarbrick's Central Auckland electorate, where there is very little policing, there is very little security. And when I talk to people who have actually moved their entire consultancies, entire practices out of the K Road Pitt Street precinct because their staff say we don't feel it's safe to come to work here, and I know they've shared that with David. So what I would say is that, of course, ACT likes to be consulted, but we are thinking about these things as well.
Moving on to the next topic, the Regulatory Standards Bill has passed its second reading in Parliament. How does the ACT Party feel about the bill passing the second reading?
Well, very pleased, because if we think about what good regulation means to New Zealanders, it's like good financial or good tax policy. It has to serve all Kiwis when we make laws. And if we think about laws like the earthquake strengthening laws that were first passed in 2016, if we had a regulatory standards test to apply to those laws, and the answer came back to say, well, you might save two or three lives every 10,000 years at a cost of billions, maybe the government of the day wouldn't have passed those laws, which have cost billions and billions of dollars to implement. They mean that historic and heritage and other perfectly suitable buildings for occupation are either empty or falling into ruin, and we should never have passed those laws. David Seymour and ACT was the only MP in Parliament to vote against them. Now we have a piece of legislation that applies the same intellectual rigour that David and the ACT Party apply to every piece of legislation that we're faced with.
What amendments have been made to the bill following the select committee process?
Well, I wasn't involved in that process, Joel, so I'm not over all of the amendments. But what I do know is that submitters who were concerned about aspects of the bill, such as the lack of giving effect to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, they're probably not going to be satisfied with where it's landed. But what the legislation is intended to do and what it will do, and I understand it will be passing, it's will be out for third reading this week, is actually say, hey, there's got to be a test. When a government wants to apply laws to private property owners or to business, or you know, even things around who should wear a life jacket, for example, in a boat, there has to be a test of is this law going to work as intended? Will the benefits outweigh the costs? And you know, if it is an impact on private property owners, what should the state do to minimise those impacts? And if necessary, actually provide for some relief for people subject to them. And we're going to apply very similar policies to the new resource management system that's coming in, because you know, if the government or councils are going to make laws, make rules that affect your property, how you can use it, and you know, the wider public benefits, you know, we think about heritage, we think about landscape, for example, then there's a case to be made. Wider public benefit, why should the private person or the business pay all the cost of that? Let's think about regulatory relief in those circumstances too. We're on the right track with this stuff.
Public submissions to the bill were vastly unpopular, with 98.7% voicing their opposition to it. Is this bill the best fit for the country, at least with these 156,000 public submissions in mind?
Well, look, pretty much anything that David Seymour and the ACT Party propose, you could probably get 156,000 people to get upset about and write in about. But it doesn't change the fact that the regulatory standards legislation is the right legislation for the right reasons. It will benefit all New Zealanders by forcing those who seek to make laws and impose rules on Kiwis to actually face up to the costs and benefits of doing it. Because at the moment, if a politician wakes up one morning, hears something on the radio that upsets them, you know, they can go and make an announcement, and the next thing you know, we've got legislation being developed and passed which doesn't necessarily actually address a real problem. If it does address a problem, we don't really know if the benefits of this legislation, these new laws, are going to outweigh the costs, and no real consideration about how it impacts on private property owners and businesses, because unless we look after their interests, why would they invest and why would they employ people? So there may have been a lot of written submissions against it, but in the end, you know, like most of the things that we need Parliament to do, this is going to be a greatly improved system for making laws, making sure Kiwis get the benefit of their taxpayer dollars.
All opposition parties have indicated they will repeal the bill if it is passed into law, if they get into government. Is this a concern for the party at this current stage?
Well, I think it should be a concern for voters and taxpayers, because when you've got parties in Parliament saying that they are not prepared to subject their own policies and their own legislation proposals to a basic test, will the law work, will the benefits outweigh the costs, and is there an impact on private property owners and business, then Kiwis should be worried about a potential government formed by the opposition parties. I mean, if these people actually don't care whether the laws they pass work, then you know, people shouldn't trust them with their votes.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the potential changes banning rough sleeping in the Auckland CBD and the Regulatory Standards Bill passing its second reading.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be right back.
Take sure.
That was Just Like Honey by Jesus and the Mary Chains, Restless Song by Shadow Community, and Jesus on Fire by Roy Irwin. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Earth Sciences NZ have released their first national risk model for flooding, evaluating exposure of New Zealand's infrastructure nationwide to floods and climate-based harm. The data shows the potential costs and damage to infrastructure at the forefront of inshore and river flooding, as well as the areas that face a greater risk of damage. However, this also shows that there are remaining issues of climate justice around those who are most vulnerable, which have not been taken into account as much as they should have in this map. I spoke to lecturer in Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Auckland and research lead at the Future Cities Research Centre, Dr. Arish Jayawadama, about this map, what it means for our infrastructure, and what still needs to be done. Just to get us started, what is this risk model attempting to address?
Well, actually, the national flood map that has been put together is a really a good way to understand how the current flooding, mainly around the inland, the inland flooding and the riverine flooding, would cause damage to the properties of infrastructure and generally around the nationally consistent picture. So that national flood model is a really good step forward. The understanding how national treatment of flooding could be understood from the national point of view, but there are also some limitations around the flooding. The picture. It means the coastal surge and some of the other sea level rise hazards are not being integrated in the flood. I think even though those informations are available in a different platform that developed by the Earth Science New Zealand, this has not been integrated into the flood model. So when we look at the national flood map, the people might get it wrong that actually this integrates the entire flood picture. But it's just to know that, this is at the moment, it's just the inland flooding based on rainfall and the fluvial flooding. But there are other tools out there to understand how sea level rise and the coastal surge could impact on those environment as well. But the key idea from the whole tool is actually it's a good step forward, but we need to be clear that it's not giving a full picture yet. So we need to really look at different ways to understand the nature of the flood and how it's going to impact on our communities of infrastructure. But saying that, this tool also help us understand where the water might go, but will not be fully giving the picture of how things will be affected, and also in terms of understanding how community adapting to it, like who can afford to adapt and who will be left behind. So that's all sort of things that we can also look at from this flood map, flood tool actually.
And just looking at the infrastructure that we are, like the infrastructural information that we are provided with, what does this say about New Zealand's current situation in terms of infrastructure preparedness for floods? And what does this mean for us facing these challenges?
Well, there's highlighting infrastructure. I think the issue is like there is a systemic consequences around there. So infrastructure decisions around transport, stormwater, even housing growth are still made with like some incomplete spatial risk information. Because of that, there is a threat to lock in exposure as well. Some greenfield development areas not yet identified as future prone under the future climate scenario. So there's still infrastructure investment today are also the climate risk of tomorrow if they are built on not updated maps. But so I think in that way this tool will tell us about how flood will change the dynamics in the future. So that will really give us good information to empower our councils or infrastructure provided to shift their planning based on this information. But it particularly thinking of, it's not enough to know, you know, who is at risk as well. But we must also need to know that how, what that means to adapt in terms of, you know, the current infrastructure, the infrastructure that we have already have being developed for previous climate, you know, based on previous climate information. So what does that mean in terms of those infrastructure for the, you know, future climate scenarios? So we have to be thinking about that technically. This information advances the, you know, the data. This data actually help us technically to advance decision making, but we need to think that it does not automatically, you know, translate into achieving, you know, climate resilient outcomes. So, yeah.
And with that said, looking both at future policy and what's missing from these, this map, what do you want to see kind of brought into this discussion about our preparedness and how we deal with floods?
We need to think about the next generations of flood model that really integrates the climate future, the social data, infrastructure vulnerability, that a model that tell us not only where the water will go, you know, when there is a, you know, exacerbating event or climate event or radio extreme weather event, but a model that tells us where people can live safely, fairly, and, you know, sustainably as well. So I think it's just, and thinking about, like, you know, low-income communities, from a social dimension point of view, they are the least able to privately fund adaptation as well. But they are the most exposed to hazard risk. So often, you know, living in low-lying area, older housing with poor drainage or insulation. So people in those low-lying low-income communities without targeted financial support, what happened is it's really good to have this risk information. But the thing is, then, when we have this information, simply it transfers a responsibility from the state to the individual. The individual has to take responsibility to now do with, you know, something with the flooding on their property. So the idea for me is, like, this could create a climate injustice. Those with the fewer resources should be the greatest burden for adaptation. So I think for me, moving forward, climate risk without financial justice is also another form of inequality that, you know, we can see from these sort of maps that's happening.
Looking towards what we have seen from the government and kind of these councils, how does this model reflect the focuses on adaptation or what preventative measures we do have in New Zealand?
I mean, definitely this model gives us a really good foundation for us to think about, you know, national flood risk picture. But the key message is that having that picture isn't just about having better data. It's about fair adaptation. So we need to think about how we can align our science, our planning, including our financing decisions. Then we can move from, you know, just looking at risk mapping to building more resilience. So I think in a way that we can confidence that as a nation that we are not, you know, leaving communities left behind who are at most risk to climate change. So I think this model is a really good model for us to understand the nature of the, you know, the flooding. It was a significant data gap that we had. So we have some methodological inconsistencies as well in the past, like how different councils assess these flooding. So I think the model really gives us an integrated approach to this. So there's really good. But thing is, so council now also have more strong evidence base to support, you know, developers or any development that enforces consistent flood risk standards. So I think in terms of adaptation, there are really positive directions that we have got. You know, public can remain informed about their, you know, the true flood exposure. Then they can really, you know, there's no reason for them to undermine their risk and, you know, the adaptation challenges they have. So I think in that way, the tool provides a really good foundation, but still it doesn't really provide us the full picture of what's the, you know, the future exposure and vulnerability to climate is going to be. We need to think about how, you know, central and local government collaboration needs to be happened to move beyond hazard mapping to really understand long-term funding for equitable adaptation. So this model really could evolve into a very national public tool to inform communities and guide councils and prioritize infrastructure adaptation investment. But again, finishing, you know, like a flat picture, like the model that created, it we can't think or we can't treat that it's just as a technical task. But we have to think about its moral and, you know, planning imperatives as well to think about how do we then, you know, use climate risk into you know, create a form of equity around adaptation.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Arish Jayawardena on the new national flood risk model.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
95BFM is throwing Border Radio in the back of their pickup truck and taking them out on the road for a spin at Studio One Vintage Guitars, Sunday, November 16th. Come along and see Deputies Kirsten, Paul and Louie in the flesh with live tunes from Fables and Moongoose.
Oh, I said I would change the way I felt about it.
Border Radio live broadcast at Studio One Vintage Guitars, 7 till 9pm, Sunday, November 16th. See y'all there now.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media. 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Garth, Garth, where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no-hat, no-play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Wallow Radio, 2 hours of music from Southeast Asia and its diaspora, complete with spicy takes, close inspections, interviews, and everything in between.
Hey.
Wallow Radio, Monday nights, 11pm to 1am. Brought to you by your hosts, Otto and JC, only on 95BFM.
Wallowie!
West Coast. Chopping.
Regan, wake
East
up.
West Coast.
Honey,
on
you're
shore.
Having those strange nightmares. Oh, no! No, it's not!
1 out of 10 on both coasts.
Oh, God! Father Damien, it's happening again!
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at ProGear.
Thank you.
know the mode, the mode is lethal. Say you wanna show me a place, the place is here, the here is inside you.
That was Blood and Butter by Carolyn Polachek, and before that was Most at Ease by Hail Meteor.
When you see Paris Hilton carrying a chihuahua in a handbag, then suddenly there's going to be a certain segment of the New Zealand population that are suddenly going to want a chihuahua.
The Wire.
In light of Guy Fawkes Day last week, the New Zealand First Party has launched a members' bill that aims to ban the public sale and use of fireworks in the country. Party leader Winston Peters, in announcing the members' bill, says the reason for this proposed move stems from its possibility to cause fires and its harm to pets. I spoke to Marcelo Rodriguez-Ferrer, an associate law professor at the University of Auckland, about the members' bill and the impact fireworks season has on animals, both companion and non-companion. We also touched on why we have seen so many members' bills come from the party in light of an opinion piece by spin-off journalist Joel McManus. Party leader Winston Peters, in announcing the members' bill, says the reason for this proposed move stems from its possibility to cause fire and its harm to pets. Despite Peters only mentioning pets here, what are fireworks' impacts on animals more widely?
Yeah, I mean, pretty serious. I think that you can have both the sort of the intentional harm towards animals, and there have been many documented instances of people using fireworks as weapons towards animals, and obviously that is really sort of horrendous. But there's lots of unintentional effects that the use of fireworks can have upon animals. So plenty of documented instances, for instance, of fireworks going off and either sort of cats and dogs running into traffic or running through windows in some instances. There was one sort of relatively serious incident of a horse impaling itself on a fence as a result of being scared by fireworks. And on, a Guy Fawkes night or the night surrounding it, sort of just the random sort of erratic sort of bangs that occur can just really sort of distress animals, even if they don't injure themselves. So the effect upon sort of animals, both domestic and sort of animals within sort of a rural context, is significant and widespread.
In terms of animals harming themselves because of the stress they're under because of fireworks, is it relatively common that we see these animals either injure themselves or even be killed?
Yeah, I think it's common enough for it to be a real concern. And I think you just need to look to the sort of significant level of support for Winston Peters, his party's members bill. I think it's going under Andy Foster at the moment. And that is a reflection of people's sort of own anecdata coming to the fore. So we've had successive petitions to Parliament in the last few years about trying to get a ban on the private sale of fireworks and private use of fireworks, because people can sort of see the effects on their own animals in a widespread way. And so that's why you see sort of level of public support sort of nearing 70% for a ban, because I think either people have companion animals or know people with companion animals that have, you know, significant distress for use of fireworks.
And I guess if we're stepping back a little bit, what are the current regulations around the private use of fireworks?
Pretty much none. I mean, there are sort of restrictions on the use of fireworks in a public place. So sort of the chaos that you saw in Dunedin in the last few days, I think a couple of people were sort of arrested for the very minor crime of using fireworks in a public place. With regards to animals as well, there is a complete ban of the use of fireworks at rodeo events that comes with an infringement fine as well. And both of those are sort of indications that sort of, you know, Parliament and the government has sort of recognised that there is a real risk of fireworks being used in a way that causes a lot of harm. Even sort of got into sort of the very real risk of using fireworks and sort of late spring, sort of early summer period where Guy Fawkes falls and sort of dune fires in Dunedin and fires in many places in the last few years as the result of fireworks indicates that, yeah, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. But as I say, fairly light regulation and pretty few restrictions. The sale of fireworks can only go in a particular period of time per year. They're not illegal for sale otherwise, but during that window there are a significant number of fireworks that are actually bought, stored by people and then used throughout the year and in ways that cause a lot of harm.
This is a question I just have out of curiosity, and I'm not sure if you would know this. Do animals, or could animals develop a sort of, you know, PTSD around this season, around Guy Fawkes season and even New Year's season?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer for certain as to whether or not sort of the time of year could be sort of associated with it. Regardless, I think that the trauma that is caused by two animals would normally be an offence under the Animal Welfare Act. So the causing of unnecessary or unreasonable distress to an animal is an offence. The problem is that when you've got sort of hundreds of people lighting off fireworks in all sorts of different directions, it's a pretty much unenforceable sort of offence in that regard, and that's why it's never really sort of been ever used in that way. But that is an indication that there is something wrong here, that if we say that we don't want animals to suffer unreasonable or unnecessary distress, and we want to sort of criminalise that, then it doesn't make a lot of sense to allow for the sort of the unregulated and wanton use of fireworks in the way that they currently are.
You mentioned that case of the horse impaling itself because of the stress it was under because of fireworks. Are these harms different depending on the setting? Are farm animals more likely in rural settings, maybe more, are they experiencing similar harms compared to more domesticated companion animals like cats and dogs?
It varies. I think some sort of animals in an agricultural context won't even care about fireworks going off, and similarly there'll be some sort of cats and dogs and so forth that won't even notice that the fireworks are sort of happening. On the other hand, some animals will be completely and utterly spooked, both in both contexts. The division between agricultural animals and domestic animals, and companion animals, is an artificial distinction and one that we place on them. And so they're going to sort of suffer very sort of similar levels of distress and sort of variances of that sort of distress depending upon the context. But yeah, certainly there are far too many instances of animals being really, really distressed, and that distress sometimes leading to sort of physical harm as well.
We know that light pollution is having an impact on, or negative impact on, bird song, sleeping patterns, and can cause collisions and deaths. Do fireworks negatively impact birds in a sort of similar way as well?
It's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that one. I only imagine that they do, in the same way, you're right, as sort of light pollution can sort of just affect their sort of circadian rhythms and sort of the way that they sort of navigate. I can't see sort of just the random use of fireworks by folk around town wouldn't have that sort of negative effect, but I'm obviously sort of, I'm not an avian scientist in that regard, so I couldn't tell you for certain. I think what has been proposed here, which is sort of restricting fireworks to sort of large displays under controlled conditions, is a really good compromise, number one, because I think that most of the public would agree that those large public displays are the ones that are really sort of spectacular and enjoyable, whereas the private fireworks available now are actually pretty low quality and of little sort of entertainment value. But more importantly, because you can kind of sort of restrict it to a specific time and a specific period, that allows for sort of the limitation of the effect that it might have on the local environment.
As this is a members bill, it will need to be pulled out of the biscuit tin to be debated on. In an opinion piece on the spin-off, journalist Joel McManus essentially refers to the number of members' bills we've seen from New Zealand First as being performative to get headlines. The bill replaces the Health Prostate Cancer Screening Services Amendment Bill, which the party put in the ballot in September. Do you agree with McManus's belief that the introduction of these members' bills, and even this members' bill in particular as well, to garner the party visibility from the media?
Yeah, look, Joel's piece was really, really good, hey, and I thought, I mean, a deep dive on sort of the nature of parliamentary procedure and sort of exposing sort of the effect and sort of operation of members' bills in this way was really, really sort of helpful. I think he's undoubtedly correct that some of the members' bills that have been put forward by the caucus of New Zealand First are definitely sort of performative and basically sort of signalling to a particular part of the electorate that their issue is being taken up and taken seriously. But as you say, sort of McManus identifies that a bunch of those have been withdrawn, and this one, the fireworks bill, is only on the basis that another bill has been withdrawn, as you identify the prostate cancer funding one from Andy Foster. I think, though, that this one might be a bit different. And my reason for that is that unlike the other members' bills, which are pretty niche issues that New Zealand First has sort of focused on, this one has sort of overwhelming public support and is in the context of about sort of 7 or 8 sort of petitions in the last few years to Parliament to achieve the same effect. So whether or not they deem it sort of a performative stunt and whether or not that was their intention, I've got a funny feeling that this actually has significantly more legs and sort of staying power than the other pieces of legislation. We've already seen sort of support, I think, from beyond the New Zealand First caucus for this members' bill in particular. And I could see a situation where there would be cross-party support and even the sort of the short-circuit sort of rule within the standing orders in Parliament that allows for a members' bill to essentially avoid that sort of biscuit tin randomness of 61 members. Sort of a plurality of members support it. And then it doesn't need to be randomly picked and can be sort of put onto the order paper for, you know, the normal passage of legislation that way. So I think simply because this has sort of touched a nerve and is reflective of a mood of the public, but I'm just kind of sick of fireworks consistently causing harm and of being sort of really limited value, the argument for, you know, for their use being some sort of loose argument of, you know, freedom and that sort of stuff. I think people are kind of getting a bit sick of that sort of approach. Yeah, that's a long way of saying that I definitely agree with Joel that this is a weird sort of approach that New Zealand First have taken to members' bills, but I think that this one might actually be one that's got more substantive chances of success.
So you essentially answered my last question there, but are you pretty positive that this members' bill will stick and it won't be sort of taken out and replaced with another members' bill by the party?
We'll see how it goes. I mean, New Zealand First is sort of pretty good at sort of being a stop clock, and perhaps the time keeps ticking and eventually sort of they decide that they've got their hit. And if it really is sort of what Joel suggested, the cynicism behind sort of withdrawing another bill and then putting a bill like this and then putting it in, I think the public would get pretty annoyed at that point. Joel's kind of exposed sort of a weakness of their plan here, which is they had originally... We're attempting to withdraw Jenny Marcroft's private member's bill, which would sort of provide general definitions within the law for a man and woman. It was a sort of a dog whistle to particular sort of anti-trans communities within New Zealand. But those same communities sort of howled at outrage with the suggestion that bill would be withdrawn to make room for the fireworks bill. And so I think if they tried to withdraw this bill, the fireworks bill, at a later time, once sort of the attention had sort of gone off it or it hadn't sort of progressed, I think you would find a significant level of public opposition, which would then sort of counteract the whole point of putting the members' bill in the first place. If they sort of erased the benefit of the populist and political sort of benefit of putting the bill in the first place and the headlines that they got and sort of the support that they got, then there wouldn't have been much point in putting it in the first place. So I think that'll be weighing on their minds. I doubt that they would withdraw it without thinking about that and thinking those consequences through.
That was the University of Auckland's Marcela Rodriguez-Ferreira on New Zealand First's members' bill proposing a ban on the public sale and use of fireworks and fireworks' impacts on animals, and why we're seeing so many members' bills come out of the New Zealand First Party.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party Simon Court, and the University of Auckland's Dr. Irish Jayawaruma and Marcelo Rodriguez-Ferrer. Nei rā hoki, te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.